Hello, this is Mark Steiner. Welcome. We are once again, second time actually, 2010 was the first time, about again to talk to Terry McMillan. Of course, Waiting for Exhale, we all know about that book, the movie. This new book, Who Asked You? What is the name of the novel? Terry, hi, how are you?
Hi, I'm fine, thank you.
Welcome, good to have you here.
Nice to be here.
I love the title here, Who Asked You? Who Asked You?
Who Asked You?
Who Asked You? This is good. I mean, so...
Thank you.
So many places to begin with this. You could talk about the subtext throughout this book, or we could talk about the characters, or... Let me just start with, you made a complex book. 15 characters,
mm-hmm.
right? Each one talking in the first person?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot. Because you have one main character, but the way it rolls is like they're almost all of them are main characters. On some, not all.
I know what you mean.
A number of them are main characters.
Well, I saw my main character, obviously, as Betty Jean, the grandmother. But I wanted to be able to get both sides of the story from the people that she was interacting with. I wanted them to be able to respond to or react to what was happening, not just to them, but in relationship to Betty Jean, the main character. So in order to do that, you know, you can only jump inside of a character's head if you write in first person or third person personal, which to me is a little hokey when I can just go for it, you know.
You did go for it in this one.
Well, I just thought, you know, that it would be more honest to hear what an 8-year-old thinks when his mother's a crackhead and he and his younger brother get abandoned.
Luther.
I didn't want to have to do that third person and from way out here. That's just...
I mean, one of the things that strikes me, I'll just say this up front. I've read a number of your books. I really love this one a lot.
Oh, thank you.
I don't know what it is. I'm still trying to parse through in my head what it is that just pulls me into this one. All your books pull me in. But... You know, when somebody has a name like Terry McMillan, and they're no, but you have that name, you know, because people you just do. They just have that name. But I think people who have not read you yet don't understand that you're a serious writer of substance. Do you know what I'm saying?
Because, I think so.
Because you have Waiting for Exhale, we have Movies Made, and people see that kind of thing. But understanding that you clearly have to get under the characters, do a lot of research, talk to a lot of people, because most of the people in this book are not you.
None of them.
Maybe a little bit?
I'm not a grandmother.
No, you're not a grandmother.
No, I would think that her sister, Arlene, whom I'm not the craziest about.
Right.
Or was it? I think she was a little dogmatic. I don't consider myself to be dogmatic, but I do have something to say about a lot of things, and sometimes I need to keep my mouth shut.
Why?
And so that's why I identified on that level, uh-huh. and hence the title.
right.
You know, I mean, I've got, I have opinions, and, you know, as the oldest of five, you know, I have younger siblings, and, you know, I also know people, and I have friends who, you know, all of us go through hard times or we have problems, and some of these things seem to be self-inflicted.
You get that theme in this book.
Yeah, and so I'm saying to myself, hold up, in real life. And so in that sense, I created every character isn't hostile.
Right.
But Arlene is, in that she's very...
unhappy, unfulfilled.
Not just that, but super critical.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a lot of people who are critical, but not super critical. But also, you know, some people that have something to say about everything often don't look at their own behavior, and that's where I was coming from. So,
So it makes me think whether it's any of the Betty Jean or her sisters or her children or any number of people in this book, especially those people, where that line is for you between the kind of personal choices you make and kind of the familial social worlds that also define your makeup and who you are. You know what I mean? I mean, what makes a son become hijack a car or make someone else jump into crack or get an attitude the way they had an attitude about whatever that is? I mean, how much of that do you think is personal responsibility with us, and how much of that is what life shoves on us?
I think it's a combination of both sometimes. Sometimes it's one or the other. My main character starts this out. The book opens with her basically reassessing her parenting skills. Even though she had a husband, she's still, I mean, really the mother plays sometimes the major role in terms of shaping a child.
Right, especially in this culture and world.
Yeah, and she's questioning whether or not she was a good enough parent, whether or not there was more she could have done. So I think on some level she suffers from guilt, even though only one of her children is, he's alienated himself from his family and his community because he doesn't identify. He has basically rejected the ghetto and to some extent even his blackness. But I think that everybody is influenced by their environment. And I think some of it has to do with how vulnerable you are and how stupid you are. because like they say, just say no to drugs. Some people don't say no, from what I understand and from my memory, drugs can make you feel pretty good. Some people just want to feel like that all the time.
Right. Right. And it takes over.
And some people can say, oh, that was fine, but I can't be doing that.
Well, you have one character, I won't give anything away in this book, though, who is very young, who starts doing drugs when he's in wheeling dealing when he's little, right? How much of that is him? Or is he accused of doing it?
I don't know. I don't want to answer that question. I can't answer that question.
Okay.
I can't. I think that a lot of people use excuses for a lot of things they do. And see?
Who asked you? I'm asked. That's my job, though.
No, but I'm saying, kidding. Some people don't want to accept responsibility for a lot of the things that happen as a result of bad choices and bad decisions that they make.
There's no question about that. I think that. And there's no question at all. I
mean, all of us.
But you see people in this book even who are also responding to the social circumstance or the familial circumstance they were thrust into at no control of their own, right? And then they all have these different responses to it. Her siblings have different responses to the worlds that they were thrust into.
Mm-hmm.
One's kind of all right and one's kind of a real...
Yeah, I know, that's right.
Ends with a B, ends with an
yes.
H.
Yeah. But also, there are also class differences sometimes within a family.
Yep.
Like
within this family?
Yes. I mean, one sister basically doesn't have the same level of respect for another one because she didn't attend college, and she says some stupid things. You would be a lot more discerning and, your choices and decision making would have been totally improved. If you'd learn how to be a little bit more critical.
You're talking about your main character.
What? No, this is her sister.
Okay. So, I mean, one of the things that about some of these characters and the people in this book, I just was kind of really, I really like some of them a lot.
I like quite a few of them.
Yeah, me too. I love Luther.
I love Luther.
Sharp young boy.
I like Luther a lot. I've read his chapter too.
Yeah, out loud?
Oh, yeah. Last night in Philadelphia.
Yeah, as long as it's a safe part. Well, that's why we can't read Kim.
Whoa, don't mention it.
See?
Duh. I have no comment about Kim. I liked her. I thought she was a pretty good nurse.
Yeah. She took care of her patients' needs. So, but
I'm not saying a word.
Okay, but in all seriousness, the companies, I really want to ask you about this. I mean, so I know you from our last conversation. I know that you approach your books as an author like an actor does a character.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into things because you're not a grandmother.
No.
You didn't raise your grandchildren. Obviously, you're going to have not a grandmother. You can't raise your grandchildren. But so you got. How did you? Did you spend a lot of time talking to a lot of women and who did this, who took their grandkids in to kind of get a feel and sense of what that's like? Or did it just come from kind of reading about it a lot? Or
no. First and foremost, it started out based on my own longstanding curiosity about how grandmothers do this. Or mostly grandmothers, even though it's grandparents.
Millions of them.
Yes.
In America.
About 6 million.
Right.
But only about 3 million documented.
Right, exactly.
You know, and those other three just don't even bother going down to get help. Or they did and they failed. I did a lot of research. I mean, there are three books that I relied on for the most part. But also, I knew of one grandmother from a long way back, and I called her to ask. And then when I was telling people I was writing this book, it seems like people came out of the woodworks. Oh, my grandma raised me.
Mm-hmm.
Or I know somebody who's doing it right now. Terry, I'll give you her name. She's my sister-in-law, my mother-in-law, whatever. So I called like 4 or 5 people and spoke to them, and it was amazing. Uncanny how their stories were all pretty much the same. And so that's where I got a lot of insight. Even though some of the stuff you kind of know, but when you hear it, it also validated what one of the books that I relied on was someone's dissertation.
Like a doctoral dissertation.
Yeah, that was turned into a book, but it had all kind, not just stats, but it also told you what these women and grandparents, the circumstances under which they become a member of what's called the second shift. But I learned directly from the grandparents and grandmothers in particular that I interviewed how they felt about doing this. Like, was it a burden? And often drugs are involved or some form of or death. And you know, because it's like a 2/3 of your life is pretty much over, and sometimes, 2/3.
Right, easily.
And you know, to start all over again, and some of these kids are even babies that they end up taking in, and sometimes they don't get any help, or it's really hard to get the state to support your efforts as grandparents. And some of them, like the social worker, you know, a lot of them had similar experiences where the social workers treated them like they were drug addicts,
right,
or like they were con artists, or they just made it hard and burdensome. And that's why a lot of grandparents don't even bother dealing with the state. They just use their own money, you know, their own resources, and do this on their own.
I mean, I was thinking about this. There was a woman I interviewed for a series we did called Just Words, which was the lives of the working poor. And I'll never forget this one woman who I just fell in love with. She had like 8 kids in her house. These were grandkids and nieces and nephews. She took in, not a dime from social services, just because she couldn't see them go under.
Yep.
And I just never forget her. I mean, she passed away, but you know, she was just amazing. And people heard her story. The phones just lit up. People gave her Christmas turkeys, brought stuff over.
Oh, wonderful.
You know, I mean, because she was just, you know, but there's so many women like this who just...
It's a selfless way to live. It really is. And, I mean, my curiosity was, how do you do this?
Right.
How where do they get this energy, But it's called love and empathy,
right,
and compassion, because they know, and in my case, my character, Betty Jean, you know, it's sort of like she had these fantasies about what she was going to do when she retired and all that. And then she basically started thinking, you know, I've done a lot. You know, but these kids, they may never get to do any of this right. stuff for the most part, and they need to be able to dream. And they need to be, they need to know what it feels like to be loved. She wasn't trying to compensate for what she thought she didn't give her own adult children. It wasn't that. She looked at these kids as victims, basically, and that they didn't deserve to be victims. So
Right. And one of the things that, you know, the other things you get into, and I let me take them step by step. I've learned how to take one thing at a time now.
Mm-hmm. Join the club.
But you also, I love the way this family speaks. What I mean by that is so many authors and people write about people who are working class people and lower middle class, however you want to put it.
Mm-hmm.
This family is a working class family, clearly, in a working class community. And we always make them inarticulate. We always make them sound stupid. We always make this sound like they didn't have enough education to get the point across. Not with this family. Even the son who's in the joint, when he writes these letters are really well done.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clear, written, concise, to the point. Whether you like what he did or who he is or not. That was an interesting choice you made, and I like that. That's a very respectful choice to have made, I think.
Well, that's why I think when the Luther and his little brother Ricky, when they come in, you know, the grandmother's always correcting them because they have up to that moment been raised in the ghetto, and they did speak incorrectly. And their grandmother, and that's one of the things they talk about, is that, you know, grandma's always correcting us, and sometimes I just don't feel like, you know, being corrected. I just want to say it the way it came out. But Betty Jean, though she's not educated, she does speak correct English. And, you know, the other two sisters, both of whom have been to college, and they are more interested in their... Well, one of them is more interested in her image, but that's just who they are. But what's his name? Dexter, who was in prison. I mean, years and years ago, I used to get a lot of letters from prisoners.
Really?
Oh, I had a whole file.
because they read your book in the joint, in the prison?
Some of them read my book. Some of them were relatives.
Uh-huh. Right.
And sometimes, yes, some of them read. But that was back in the day before email, when you'd get fan mail from your publisher. They just send you these boxes or big envelopes. And so some of these, I could tell when I saw the hyphens and the numbers that it was from a prisoner. And I would read these. And even some of my relatives, it was amazing. I mean, I could tell the ones that were deep into the thesaurus. And the dictionary, okay?
Right.
And some of them who just were readers. And not only that, but, you know, everybody that commits a crime isn't stupid. Well, yeah, they're stupid, but dumb.
Right,
they're
exactly.
not dumb.
Right.
And a lot of them are quite intelligent. And so I wanted to portray a character who... was rather eloquent in the way that he expressed himself. And a lot of them are.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them are. You know, and that's one of the reasons why they write long letters. You couldn't read a long letter if it was inarticulate, if you couldn't even decipher a sentence. And those aren't the ones who write the long letters. They are not. And, you know, so... I thought it was befitting, and even some of the references that he makes, and the whole idea, but all of them want to be jailhouse lawyers, you know?
Right. Everybody, right.
But even still, I had lawyers at a reading when I read this.
The letter from?
Dexter.
Dexter to his mom?
Yes.
Yeah.
And they were like, he got that summary judgment. He understood. You know, and, you know, I used to work as a legal secretary for lawyers. So, but also some of the stuff, they know this stuff. They live in the law libraries.
Right. That's their life.
You know, that's their life. And they read these cases and all that.
Right.
So, you know, I just, it was a level of respect that I was trying to give on one hand. And that's all I want to say about the, you know.
That's fine.
Yeah.
But I mean, it also shows that you, it's through your books that, even though these characters aren't you, it's the life you led before you gained some acceptance and notoriety as a writer come through this, because you've had experiences beyond. And you know, people look at somebody who's made a name for themselves, and people know the word Terry McMillan, and she's Terry McMillan, but there was a Terry McMillan before there was a Terry McMillan. And
well, even you know, I mean, some of the letters that I've received were after my work became very popular, and some of them I didn't read, because some
can't
of
them
were long. And sometimes I would have my assistant open them and say, tell me what this one says. What do they want? What, you know, they just want, didn't she have a pile? People just want books. People that want pictures. Terry, this is a relative. Whoa. I mean, but I have sent books, clothes, money orders. You have no idea. I have paid legal fees.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But I'm.
We'll leave it there. So I can't find this passage. It was Betty Jean talking with
Tammy.
No, this is Arlene, I think, about Christianity, where she was saying, do you ever read the Bible?
Oh, it was, what's her name, Venetia.
Yeah, Venetia. But do you ever read the Bible? Why not? And what do you believe? I went, there was a bunch of little passages in there. I went, oh, wow, I love this one.
That was my favorite.
I just love that, because mostly I could take that piece and we could riff on it for days about, because it says, I think, is that something that says something about Terry McMillan, about how you wrestle with this whole notion of what religion's about?
Maybe, I don't know. I just think that some people go overboard. I can't stand it when people, and I mean, I'm on Twitter, and some of these people are, everything is about the Lord and God will do, you know, and I'm saying to myself, okay, I am a Christian. I believe in God. But, you know, God gave us certain abilities. And if you don't take some responsibility for some of the stuff that happens to you, you know, if you're gonna rely on God to get you out of it, who are you going to blame for getting you into it?
Right.
You know what I'm saying?
No, I do know.
And it's like, you know, I mean, come on.
God's will, free will. How about some free
Thank
will?
Thank you. You know what I mean? And God gave us the ability to think and to think clearly and to be honest and gave us the option of being able to stand on our own two feet, to learn from our mistakes, to fall down and get back up, you know? And I don't know. I just think in some cases, you know, and I can't stand it when I'm get on the, oh, well, you know, the Lord will see you through. I mean, I just was stopped in the Philadelphia Union Station, or whatever it was, the train station.
Train station, right.
By this woman who walks up to me, and she was a little nutty, I thought, and said, hello. And I said, hello. Black woman, she was like looking at me all weird and everything. And then she said, I'm a writer. She just didn't say it out of nowhere. I was observing the bagels. Okay, and then, and I think deep down inside she knew who I was. She tried to pretend like she didn't. And so she ended up telling me she was on her way. I don't know if it was D.C., because she's a writer, and she's going to read from her book. And I said, oh, that's nice. Best to you. And then the escort and I were over here getting ready to, we were pouring our coffee, and then she comes. She had left and had come back.
I don't know.
And she said, I write religious. And she also had the whole God thing going on and God bless you. Oh, and do you feel blessed today?
I hate that.
And I said, I'm blessed every day I can breathe. Okay, and she said, yes, but do you feel blessed today? And I wanted to say, go get on the train. Okay, then she leaves and comes back.
On the third time.
With a little card that looked like a Hallmark card. She says, here's one of my poems. And as soon as I read the first line and the last line, and my escort had one too, and she said, Terry, you can keep this one. And I said, I already know what it says. I know what it says. And she was like, I don't need you to preach to me. That's my thing. I don't need you to preach to me. You don't know how I feel about God. You don't know what role that I feel and that I'm aware of that God plays in my life. And I do not need you to tell me.
And one of the things that also about that little passage that hit me very deeply was that her response, Betty Jean's response to Venetia about the Bible, and there was a line in there where you said, look, these words were written by a lot of people over a period of time. A lot of different people wrote this, so we don't know what it, so that was like, I said, this is like, that's like a scholar's line. You know what I'm saying? Somebody who's really thought about the Bible.
Did she say something about my, it's sort of like a novel? Maybe not. No, I don't know if she said anything about it's like a novel.
She said that's why she likes reading novels. She likes reading novels because she knows it's fiction and she knows it's that there's going to be something coming out in the end. So it was just, I read that and I went, whoa, that was a very powerful little piece that you put in there. There's a couple things, like there's like five or six, maybe 10 things I could pick out of this book like that, but that was one of the most powerful little chunks.
Well, thank you. But, you know, because I just, sometimes people just get on my nerves. And especially that Venetia chick. Oh, my goodness. I mean, her husband is cheating on her. And then when they find out, you know, maybe she's going to take him back. And she comes up with some lame thing about, you know, about God wanted him to come back to her or something. She uses forgiveness. And her sister basically knows she's lonely and she doesn't know what else to do. That's the bottom line. But will she own up to that?
No.
Turn it over. That's what, you know, I mean, come on.
Tara McMillan's with us. Talking about her latest book, Who Asked You? We'll be right back. The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. For more information, www.mecu.com.
Hello, liver cancer. Let me introduce you to my gang of bullies.
If you've been diagnosed with any gastrointestinal cancer, consider University of Maryland Greenbaum Cancer Center. A highly specialized team of experts will review your case and recommend promising solutions, many found only at National Cancer Institute designated centers like here.
Hey, tumor, take a hike.
University of Maryland Medical Center, medicine on a mission. Learn more at umm.edu. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and we're here at the studios at Clean Cuts in D.C., where we do all of our Washington, D.C. work. We're talking to Tara McMillan, author of Waiting to Exhale, A Dollar Short, A Day Late, and this new one, Who Asked You? And I just, one of these novels, I'm just in love with this novel. I've already decided to give it to a bunch of people because they need to read it.
Thank you.
On a couple levels, people need to read it. So, some of these other people in this book, her husband who has Alzheimer's. He is a trip.
Lee David.
He is a trip.
I like him.
I like him too. I mean, I know people have Alzheimer's and, you know, grandparents had Alzheimer's. And
they're in different stages too.
Right. But he is, I won't talk too much about him because you can't say a lot of what he says in the book on the radio.
Well,
what are those little teeny things you give him to say, like, you know, what he can't do and...
Well, then why mention it?
Because I couldn't resist.
Okay.
I just couldn't resist. But her sons.
Mm-hmm.
I'm thinking about Tammy. I'm thinking about Quentin. Right, Quentin, the chiropractor.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Tammy is her neighbor.
Tammy's her neighbor.
Her white neighbor.
Right, right. And so, but they both have this... There are interactions between race in this book that are interesting, and they're not like hit you over the head with things, but they subtly kind of try to go under some of the issues, whether it's Tammy being white, was married to a black man, their kids, and what their kids become, or whether it's Quentin and his kind of thing about running away from the ghetto and having to live in a white world and then gets smacked with what it means to get that can happen to him, and the social worker. I don't even know what race the principal is, but...
Oh, well, there's also, you know, I mean, black people can be racist against each other, too.
Right. But it's a the subtlety, to me, there's all those dialogues are about the subtlety of you're picking up the subtleties of race, the things that are difficult to talk about that you just want to put out there in a different way, and you're kind of if you can do it through a novel, through characters, without it becoming kind of a preachy essay.
Yes, didactic and all that. Like
didactic here, is the word I'm looking for.
Yeah, yes. Like here I am. I'm going to look down on you and tell you how, you know, I'm going to use these characters as puppets, which I do not believe in.
Right.
Just to get across how I feel, because that's not the case. You know, I'll say, you know, I mean, back in 2001, I mean, I did my homework in Los Angeles, in particular in the hood. There were still different races that were neighbors.
Right.
Yeah. And so I thought, okay, and someone told me this a long time ago. It's amazing what happens in with your memory, what pops up. That, oh, yeah, I had a Korean neighbor on one side, a white neighbor on the other side. The Korean is still there. The white person finally moved out only because, you know, the kids grew up or whatever, and they just wanted to move whatever, wherever. And I just took all that and ran with it. But then I went and did all the stats. I looked it up and, you know, to see. And there are some places that still exist. But I wanted my main character, whose friend lived across the street.
Tammy.
And she was a little younger than her. And this was during a time when racial relations weren't quite as they are now in certain areas of the country. And so back then, there were black women that got mad when they see a white woman with a black man.
It still happens.
Huh?
People still get upset.
Yeah. Okay. And I also wanted to show friendship between races and two women. Because to this day, I mean, I've had, like, white friends for years. But we, I mean, you know, it's, I just, you know, I had white assistants. But, and they knew me, but I didn't, like, go to work thinking, oh, gee whiz, my assistant is white.
Right.
Or my friends are white. Sometimes, and I'm trying to get past it, I hope one day to be past it, where I don't have to refer to anybody that way. Not just their ethnicity, but, oh, he's gay. Or, you know, or she's Chinese. Whatever. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just sick of it. You know, even someone's age. You know, I would like to not to have to refer to them that way. And it's going to be a while. I'll probably be dead before I get there, but, you know, so, except if it makes a difference in helping you to understand something about them. Because if somebody is 72, it's worth mentioning.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
I don't know.
But I mean, it's you because you. We live in a world where we get the complexity of race and racism and structural racism, all the stuff people talk about, is very real and it's with us. It's not. You know, it's not that's part of the American culture, unfortunately, and it's something people battle against all the time to try to change, and at least some people do, and because it's there, it's very real. But the interpersonal relationships sometimes.
And yeah, that, you know, like, I mean, there are like, I mean, I call my family like the Rainbow Coalition now.
Mm-hmm,
I mean,
right.
I mean, I just had a little Jewish niece. And I say that because I like saying it. You know, I just like saying it, you know, but I have like all different ethnicities in my family. And it's like you look at the kids, you don't know what they're made of.
Right.
But and I like that, even though for the most part, I still like the idea of knowing that some of them look black, you know, because I still want to look black, even though I like the idea that you can't tell what they are.
I have a grandson. All my grandsons are like that.
Yeah.
And they just, nobody.
People like, I like it when people try to guess.
Right.
And they can't.
I know. He came up to Avi and said, what are you? Some kid in school. I says, I'm black. I'm Jewish. I'm Puerto Rican. I'm this. I'm Italian. And he went through his whole list. He said, that's who I am.
Yeah. Yeah. See? Yeah. And just like years ago when Tiger Woods said it. And everybody got upset with him about it. And I said, but you know what? He told the truth. Which part of your ethnicity do you choose to identify with? You know? But I also know people that have mixed race children. And like, if one is black and one is white, you know, in some cases they're trying to raise a kid like they're white.
Right.
They're rejecting their the blackness.
Not and healthy.
That really annoys the hell out of me.
Well, but then you've got your Quentin in the book, who has his own dilemmas around race and...
But his little girl, I loved her.
Yes, his daughter.
I loved his daughter. I can't remember her name, but the bottom line is she said, oh, yeah, Dad, I'm going to the hood with my homies. I was like, and as I'm writing this, I'm like cracking up.
So it just came out. Is that how it works with you? It just came, you're just there and your characters start talking to you. Stuff just comes out. You're not expecting
it to come out. I mean, otherwise, why waste my time? Right. I mean, once I know who these people are, that's why I love first person. I love for them just to tell me. You know, even a lot of the things, even when, what's his name, Quentin, you know, fast forward, because I wanted to smack him.
Especially in the beginning.
Ooh. But when his, I just like how what he had to learn and how it came about. I'm trying not to give everything away.
Well, you're not giving away a thing. I'm not going to let you do that anyway, because it's too interesting to watch this whole thing. Because one of the things to say is that this book spans a bunch of years.
Mm-hmm. It's not almost 10, 9 years.
Right.
Yeah. But the thing is that I love it when a character evolves and not like I'm being a puppet tier.
So you did, when you started this, we won't give anything away, but when you started this, whether it's Quentin or Luther or whichever character it is, you didn't say, okay, this is where my character's going to begin and we're going to end up here and I'm going to fill in the middle.
Oh, no.
That's not how it works.
I didn't know. I had no idea how it was going to end. All I knew was that Betty Jean was going to raise those kids. I didn't know how they were going to evolve, except in one case, one thing I did know, and based upon almost everything that I've seen over the years, a lot of those kids fare very, very well.
The ones who were raised by their grandparents.
Yep.
Yeah.
And that's why I think I had Venetia say in there, and I just saw this the other day, about how you see like a lot of football players at the Super Bowl saying, I want to say hi to my grandma.
Right.
And you hear it a lot.
A lot.
And the thing is this, over the years, I just noticed this over the years, how many of them say it. And they say that they either say their grandma or their mom. You know, every once in a while you hear them mention their wives. But you hardly ever hear them mention their dads.
Hardly ever.
Hardly ever. And grandma and my mom.
One of the things that made me think of is that what you just said. I don't want to digress because I want to finish this, but I was thinking about it, was that we did a show not long ago, the whole question of fatherhood, and we explore that a lot on the air. But I read this study that said of all the racial groups in America, of fathers who have children but they're not with their children, that black men spend more time with kids who are not living with them than any other group in the country. That is interesting kind of juxtaposition to the other one, which is fathers are not in the lives, and how this complex, I really want to figure this out. Seemingly contradictory things we think about where life is, and that's the kind of stuff that intrigues me to think about what that means.
Well, I need more than a minute.
Yeah, I know. No. I'll send it to your publicist, and you take a look at it. It really, yeah. It's really a very interesting
phenomenon.
Yeah.
Okay.
That made me think of that as I was looking at this. You know, and again, you didn't spend a lot of time with a social worker.
No,
not a lot.
No.
But
I liked the time that I did spend with her.
Why did you like it?
Because I like the idea that, you know, and to some extent, some of these people are like cattle to them. When you get worn out.
As a social worker, you get worn out.
Yeah, but it's almost like so many public servants. You know, I mean, you know, you go through customs or whatever. Sometimes they want to make things difficult for you.
Right.
Because they're just sick of the BS.
Right.
You know, for the people that have gotten on their nerves or have tried to get away with things. And so I found that a lot of these, I wanted a social worker that she was just a name or a number. You know, like, okay, what's your story? And then what she was really thinking, she was betting I love that. I love that. You know, she's betting herself a chocolate chip or
right,
oatmeal
right.
cookie and a Starbucks.
Right.
You know, like, yes, but, and I know that there will probably be an up so far so good, I haven't had any social worker get on my case. But also, you know, I'm not, you know, that's right up there with years ago with some black men say, why aren't there any good black men in your books? Why are you always dogging the brothers? Well, you know, I'm not writing about all of them. I just picked out a few, and guess what? The ones that are good, you ignored them. So if you choose to look at the negative, that's what you get. And so I just wanted to give an example of what some mothers, grandmothers, go through trying to get help, secure help. I mean, because if you have a kid, if you have a grandchild, they get sick.
And you don't have custody?
You can't take them to the doctor.
Right.
You can't do it, among other things.
Right.
Picking them up from school. If your name's not on that list.
That's why her riff with the principal was so
wonderful. I love that. And see, that's when you get the, that's when race does come into play. You know, it's sort of like he's black. He understands what's going on in the hood right outside of his school and all that. So he basically tells her how you can get around all of the red tape.
He seemed like a really decent character, a decent human being.
Yeah, I liked him.
Even though he didn't play a big part in the book, he was...
No.
An important little key, I thought.
Yeah.
And all that. No, I liked him. He was a good bridge. He was the kind of thing that you kind of need to have in books like this.
I also liked Omar.
So do I. Felt bad for him, but I liked him. Just because what he had to go through with his mother, all that stuff. But the way you portrayed him dealing with his sexuality was really an important little... That was really a powerful little piece, that one piece towards the end of the book with Omar.
I loved it. And I read it to someone who used to be very dear to me, who actually cried and asked, could I give him a copy to share with his family? I said, no, buy the book. No, I didn't.
You did not.
No, I didn't say that. I didn't say that. Of course I didn't. But, you know, the thing is that I think, too, that a lot of people don't understand how much and sometimes how easy it is to empathize and or how difficult it is. But, and that's one of the beauties to me of writing in first person, because I get to stay out of it. But at the same time, I couldn't write it if I didn't get it.
Right.
You know, and
you do get it.
Yeah, sometimes I get it.
That's one of the places you get it. You really get it.
Yeah, but also, but the other thing is this, is that, I mean, that's the beauty to me of writing in first person, because you have to get lost as the author. And again, I can't stress enough that the characters cannot be puppets. They just can't. And any idiot can see through that. A fifth grader could see through it. You know?
I mean, Omar is like, it was funny because reading the thing about Omar, and I was making some notes on Omar, and then the Pope came out with saying that that the Catholic Church spends too much time worrying about homosexuality and contraception. I'm going, oh.
Mm-hmm. I was like, go, Pope
Francis.
Yes.
You know?
And they've quoted him quite a bit.
You have quoted him quite a bit?
No, I said he is quoted.
He's caused.
And that's a big deal.
Huge. It's huge. You know, and I think.
I just saw it on MSNBC yesterday, and I was like. Power to the Pope.
Really?
You know?
And I don't even go to church or anywhere else. So, so you know. So, I mean, it's almost as if you were. Had these characters in this book, and there are different parts of things that maybe I'm reading too much into this, but you'll tell me in a minute if I am, that you have thought about and wrestled with that are coming through the characters you've allowed to live. I'm not saying they're you. I'm saying...
No, they're not me. I think that I write about what I care about. I write about what I find disturbing. I write about characters who are going through things that either they are aware of or unaware of. And some of it is self-inflicted, some of it not. But one thing they all have in common is the common denominator that I give them is that whatever it is that they're afraid of, running from, whatever, they're going to have to face it in this story. Because that's the way I think life is. The things that you run from are the things that chase you. And a novel is an opportunity for me as an author to house some of that. And
yeah, right.
You know, I mean, otherwise,
right. You let characters speak for themselves, but as an author, there's always this interaction with your own consciousness that comes out, because that's what it is, isn't it? Being a writer, it's a mixture of those two things.
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, sometimes I don't particularly like the struggles of my characters, and some cases I don't like the way they handle them. And this is one of the reasons why I chose them and created this personality and all that, because there are a lot of things that get on my nerves and people that get on my nerves and people I don't understand and people I don't necessarily empathize with. And so those are also why those characters fascinate me more than anything. I mean, I've never been in prison. I know people who have been in prison for crimes they did commit and crimes they didn't commit.
We see those stories all the time.
Yeah, but also there are some that committed them who are arrogant as hell, and they lie about it. They have made themselves believe they didn't do it.
Right.
But also there are so many stereotypes, and I like to sort of refute those.
I think one of the things I loved about that part of the book, at least the early part of it, was Betty Jean being very clear with Dexter. You could see that she loves him to death, but saying, boy, you've got to admit, own up. You can't just keep playing this game if you want to be serious about who you are and what happened to that person, what you did to him, that person. And
I love that.
I do. That's another one of my favorite parts. It was like, so you got to own up to what is this woman going through every day?
Yeah.
After
you know,
what you
it's
did
not
to
all
her.
About you.
Right.
It's not always about just you.
I've met a lot of people who've been inside, and there's something about that can make you very self-centered. It's all about me all the time.
That's what I noticed when I read a lot of those letters. Me, 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 me. You know? And then, oh, by the way, how's Dad?
Right. Right. Well, at least he asked.
Well, yeah, but it was like three. And see, I've read that chapter, but I can't, when I submitted it, my editor said, Terry, is there any way to edit the letter? Make it a little shorter? I said, absolutely not. Then
takes
that
away
means
from the whole
effective.
Thing.
Right. That's the whole point of it.
Right.
Is that it's too long. You know? I mean, I used to kind of skim them and think, okay, let me get back to there. Go back. Because they just go on and right. on and right. on and on. But the detail is unbelievable.
And also, that's not to digress again, but also what I've discovered in interviewing a lot of people, especially on the show when they've spent time in prison, these brothers can just go on for days. Do you have a period at the end of the sentence? Can you take a breath? You know? But you also in this book, different other books, there was a, you know, a lot of something like Waiting for Exhale and a couple of others, there were a lot about young, upwardly mobile people and certain class thing, but you really kind of didn't do that in this book. I mean, there's obviously some of the sisters have made it and went to college and married somebody who had some money and had these babies and did what they do. But this is a different class world you're exploring than you have in the last couple of books.
Yeah, I guess.
Not a big deal to you. It's just what came.
Yeah, I mean, I don't deliberately think, oh, gee whiz, I'm going back to the hood.
Right.
No.
Right. No, but it wasn't going back to the hood in this book, because this was a working class neighborhood which was really a much nicer place that's begun to fall apart.
Yes.
It's not quite the hood. I mean.
Well, I refer to it as a hood because I'm an elitist. No, I'm just kidding. I'm just being facetious, okay?
Trinetta went to the hood.
Yeah, Trinetta lived in the hood. Okay. But no, I think that, I mean, the beauty of it is that in a lot of families, there is a mixture. Some people make it.
Right.
Some people live here. Some
exactly.
people live over there. And that's why, you know, what's her name? Arlene was hoping that maybe she could get, you know, Betty Jean to move a little up the hill. Maybe I can find you someplace here, you know. But there's a, and I find that to be true in a lot of families, except you have some families that everybody just lives in the hood. Some of them just don't escape, and in some cases, some of them don't want to escape.
Right. Oh, no, right, right. That's life. That's what they want to be.
You know, but the in cases like Waiting to Exhale and even Stella, you know, there are a lot of upper middle class and upper class black people in this country.
Lots.
Okay? And they don't try to apologize for it.
And nor should people apologize
No,
for
they
it.
Shouldn't. So that's why some news... interview, some guy interviewed me, I don't know what city he was from, but he said, you know, don't you think, this felt really much like a soap opera to me. And I said, really? What? He said, you don't think so? And I said, you know, you just insulted me.
Really? Did you get him walk out?
No, I didn't walk out, but I said, my book is not like, no, this story is not like a soap opera. I said, first of all, most soap operas, those problems that these people have are so superficial. It's I said, don't even insult me. My characters are realistic. They're three-dimensional. They have real problems. Their feet are on the ground, and they have to deal with them. And guess what? They also reach a plateau. That doesn't happen in a soap opera.
That's right.
You know, and don't offend me like that. So, anyway, I don't know what happened.
But, you know, I also like, we won't talk about the ending, but I just, where it all comes to and where Luther comes to, and Luther's going to be okay.
I hope so.
I think he will be okay. I think you'll be okay.
Yeah, I'm fine.
Terry McMillan, this is just always a pleasure to see you.
Thank you.
Who asked for you? I'm loving
you. No, who asked you, not who asked for you.
What did I say?
You said, who asked for you?
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry. Let me say it again. Terry McMillan, who asked you? Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
It's been good to see you again.
Thank you.
Thank you. We have to take a short break, but don't go away. When we come back, you'll hear a unique interview with King Peggy, this year's Maryland Humanities Council, One Maryland, One Book author. Talks to us about her memoir and her journey to becoming the king of a Ghanaian village. You don't want to miss this. Don't go away. And I want to remind you all to join me this weekend, this coming Sunday, at 2 p.m. at the Radical Book Fair Pavilion at the Baltimore Book Festival. I'll be moderating a conversation between Gar Alperovitz, Dr. Lester Spence, and Maryland State Senator Jamie Raskin. We'll speak about Alperovitz's book, What Then Must We Do?, and ask the difficult questions about the economy, corporate capitalism, and alternatives for the 21st century. For more information, go to baltimorebookfestival.com.